Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective. I'm Ted Berg, joined on the line by the Athletics Mets beat writer Tim Britton. And Tim, I gotta say, I stumbled upon, while searching for something about another podcast, I stumbled on a website that I don't know how accurately, but purported to track podcast performance. And I learned that we are disproportionately popular in Great Britain, that we have plummeted in Canada. So good riddance to you, hosers. And that this was the big piece of information I gleaned. Also disproportionately, surprisingly popular among baseball podcasts in Finland.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Obviously, my last name carries us pretty far in the UK. Even with the different spelling, they appreciate creativity. And you know, Finland, I was once... Reasonably close to Finland.
So yeah, you're something of a Nordic enthusiast, I believe.
Yeah, in that I've been to I guess every Scandinavian country except Finland. So they're trying to
subtly win me over. Careful, you're gonna alienate our Finnish fans. Finland is not technically part of Scandinavia. Or it's debatable whether it's part of Scandinavia. It seems to be a controversial subject and one we probably want to stay away from.
Okay. Yes, I do not want to alienate anyone, especially not our Finnish fans.
But seriously, if you are listening from Finland, thank you. And please email me. I want to know more. And we could talk about Finnish baseball, which I don't know if you've ever seen, Tim, but it is a fascinating, fascinating version of the game.
How is it different? I have not seen it.
It is so different. It looks like I have described it this way before. It looks like someone watched a single baseball game while on like a ton of hallucinogenic drugs and then tried to recreate it from memory like 5 years later. The action starts, the pitcher stands, home plate is a big circle. The bases are in a zigzag and the pitcher stands on home plate and throws the ball straight up in the air. And then it comes down and bounces. He throws the ball straight up in the air and then gets the heck out of there. And it comes down and bounces and the batter then hits it. And from there, it's like a little more like baseball, but the bases are much, it's like a base zone. But it's cool. It's like if you find, there are full match videos on YouTube and it's mesmerizing. Like you can get into it.
The important thing, though, is the pitcher standing 60 feet 6 inches away, or is he maybe 61 feet and 6 inches away?
Well, he's trying to throw it 60 feet 6 inches in the air, but he is standing right on the plate. It'll mess with your head as a baseball fan a little bit. But yeah, that is in the news as well. Some changes going on. So one we talked about, which I haven't seen credited to Jason Stark, but I understood to be at least his idea, one he proposed in a column, which is having the DH, and this is in the Atlantic League, which is being used, I think, as a little bit of a petri dish for Major League Baseball now. They're going to have it so that the DH is in place until the starting pitcher is pulled from a game, which I think was a rule we both really liked.
Yeah, it's actually something I've thought about even before I saw Jason write about it. My idea was basically that, you know, you had an individual hitter stood in for each individual pitcher. So let's say if Jacob DeGrom started the game for the Mets and Pete Alonso was your DH, Alonso would bat anytime DeGrom's spot in the order came up. But if you went to a different reliever, then you had to use a different hitter. Or you could double switch Alonso into the game at first base and have the pitcher spot move somewhere else. So that way you could still have an opener if you wanted to. You know, you could have, if you're opening with Jacob Barnes before Joey Lucchesi, maybe you make Kevin Pillar your original DH and then replace him with Alonso going forward. Or if you got a good long relief appearance, you could use the same pinch hitter multiple times. But
this has already gone over my head. I think I like the other one.
That's one of the problems. I was actually planning on writing about it like months ago, right around the time Jason wrote his story. And I was just like struggling to explain it to anyone. So it's a good, it's a flaw in most of my thinking in that, you know, I get 30 seconds in and it's over someone's head. But it made sense.
That's a good problem. That's a good problem if you're above everyone else's level. Speaking of above everyone else's level, since
good
we
transition.
Last spoke, hey, that's right. I'm a pro. since we last spoke, the Mets have, we're now talking on Thursday evening after what was supposed to be a Mets game, but instead got rained out and will be replayed, I think, in June, before they head to Denver on Friday to presumably get snowed out. The Mets won 3 games in a row and now they're in first place. Do you think if they don't play another game all season, will their 5-3 record and .625 winning percentage be enough to win them the National League East?
Yeah, I mean that's setting a high bar. What is 625 over the course of 162? That's gotta be.
I mean it's 160, right? Because if it's 5-3, then it's 100, and it would be either 101 and 61 or 100, you know, it's right around 162. Like it's right around there. Cause if you multiplied 50 by 20 and 5 by 20 and 3 by 20, it would be 160.
Yeah. So while you were doing that, I actually broke out a calculator.
Who's on another level now? I
figured it out properly. And the other team in the National League East would have to win 102 games. And they don't look capable of that in the current moment. So that would be one way to win it. I think there might be some issues with other teams claiming unfairness in that regard. But, you know, it's nice when the Mets play 37.5% of their season in a 30-hour span from Tuesday at 4 o'clock till Wednesday at 10 p.m. And get 3 wins in that stretch against the Phillies. The first game didn't look good until the end in extra innings where they come back, and then they carried over the momentum from that and played, I thought, really 2 crisp games on Tuesday night in the nightcap and then on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. The starting pitching has been terrific throughout, really through 8 games. They've had one subpar start, one that David Peterson rebounded from and redeemed himself from on Wednesday.
More than redeemed himself. I felt like that was that's the best start of his career, right? That was an incredible start, and he looked just so sharp. It looked like he was throwing a little bit harder. He had his breaking stuff working better. I was really hopeful. It made me very hopeful for this season.
Yeah, I think that was the best start of his young career at this point. Like the velo was up at 95, which we haven't really seen from him before. The slider, which was really good the first start. The problem in his first start was that he was just leaking with his four-seam fastball a little bit. So he didn't throw that as much on Wednesday night. Threw more two-seamers. It's nice when you have guys like Walker is kind of the same way. Who can throw the four-seam and two-seam interchangeably. Like, you know, if the four-seam's not working, they can throw the two-seam, or they can throw them off one another. That's a really hard thing to do. I think that's something that most casual baseball fans don't understand, is how distinct those two pitches are, and that attempting to throw both of them in the same game can be very difficult. Like, I remember having long conversations with Rick Porcello during his good seasons and his bad seasons in Boston and New York about basically, like, having those two things operate as distinct pitches. And if you're able to do, when he was able to do that, he could win a Cy Young. And when he wasn't, he was giving up a lot of home runs. So That's a really hard thing to do. It's nice that Peterson has a fallback fastball when the four seam's not working, right, that he could go to on Wednesday, and that, you know, the slider and change play. Like, we talk a lot about Peterson's poise, which I think we've all seen, we know about. That's part of the reason he can bounce back against the same team 8 days later and pitch the way he did on Wednesday. But, you know, poise doesn't mean a whole lot if you don't have some stuff to go along with it. And he's got the stuff. I think that was the concern with him last year coming into the majors. Like, is the stuff major league ready? Can he get swings and misses in the strike zone with his fastball? Can he get guys to chase? And we've seen over the course of, you know, what is it, 11 starts or so, that he does. And you know, Wednesday night was the best example of that.
Yeah, and I mean, if especially considering just like the herky jerky nature of this schedule so far, the starting pitching's been unbelievable. I mean, it's just, you know, like Stroman and DeGrom after two starts are both have ERAs under one. Walker's been good. Like that, I think there's been, you know, concern about the back of the starting rotation, especially with Syndergaard and Carrasco out. And now I would say there's no concern. At least that's how I feel. I would say, like, if I'm assessing problems on this team, I feel like, and it's a funny thing, three wins will do. I feel like there are a lot fewer problems now than I did 4 days ago. And I'm just like, I'm not worried. I'm not worried about the rotation. I feel like between the guys that they have and the guys that are coming back, it's going to be a top flight type group.
Yeah, the rotation ERA is in the low twos. I'm not sure exactly the number. It was 2.45 going into Peterson's start, so it lowered from there. Maybe it's like 2.23 or something. I read it earlier today, and then I forgot what it was. And, you know, one of the issues people have mentioned with all of these postponements early in the season, you know, the Mets are going to have to play a lot of games in a more compressed time period later in the season. One thing that makes you feel okay about that is that you have the starting depth. You know, if Carrasco and Syndergaard come back into your rotation and Peterson and Lucchesi are your 6 and 7 guys, you know, if you have two doubleheaders in a week that are 7-inning doubleheaders, you can have those guys be your 27th guy that day and give you a pretty good outing in a way that, you know, you wouldn't trust Philadelphia's 6th starter the same way you would trust David Peterson by that point in the season, I don't think. You know, when they're 4 and 5 are Matt Moore and Chase Anderson. So I think that's one silver lining of the postponements is, you know, by that point, you should have some of your better starting pitchers or more established starting pitchers back. And so you're not like dipping into bullpen games and that type too often at that point in the season.
And I mean, but meanwhile, also the bullpen has looked a little bit better. Familia's outing in the most recent game, what was it, Wednesday's game, notwithstanding, right? But then Aaron Loop bailed him out in a huge way. And in general, it's been, you know, yeah, like I said, everything's just a little sunnier when the Mets win 3 in a row.
Yeah, everything's nicer when Aaron Loop is getting the huge double play on his first batter rather than hitting the batter to allow it to bring in a run. It's a big difference. You know, I think you've seen the expanded confidence in May, Castro, and Loop. Familia is still not quite there, walking the leadoff guy on Wednesday, which is the thing they don't want to see from him, you know. And even it's not just that he walked JT Realmuto, it's that he fell behind 3-0 on the path to walking him. And that's what he wasn't doing when he pitched better on Tuesday, for instance. I think 11 of his 13 pitches Tuesday were strikes. That's what you want to see out of Familia because his stuff is good. Just throw it down the middle, let it dart one direction, and it usually works
right,
out pretty well.
Take more of what you want. The Jose Alvarado plan, which he has like even less control, it seems. But, you know, I don't really know where to throw the strike. I'm just going to try to throw it for a strike.
Yeah, it's the old wiffle ball approach, you know, let the pitch move wherever it will, but I'm going to aim it down the middle.
Now, did you play chair rule wiffle ball or just like a up against the garage?
So when, you know, we initially played garage, so it was the part of the wall between the two garage doors. But then when I was younger, my dad put in a pool in our backyard. So we then played wiffle ball around the pool. The pool wasn't out if you hit it into the pool. And our strike zone was a large circular, like outdoor table, like a patio table turned on its side. So you could throw a pitch that was like 6 inches off the ground, but if it hit the table on a fly, that's a strike.
You have the rule? So like a real fun rule that I didn't know about that was until I played intramural wiffle ball in college. And the rule was that if you threw the pitch and you hit it was a chair. If you hit the chair without the batter swinging, it was a one pitch strikeout.
Oh no, we did not. We had plenty of strikeouts because our strike zone was so enormous. We had plenty of strikeouts. And like, you know, I once had a game against my brother where I had like 22 strikeouts in 9 innings and lost because he hit a home run. So it was very much a three true outcome style of wiffle ball, presaging what we would see in baseball years later.
I can say that I had a three pitch, three strikeout wiffle ball inning in college, probably the crowning glory of my athletic career. And also played a very different variety of wiffle ball in my backyard because our home run was basically unobtainable. I don't think it was ever actually done. It was there was just a tree blocking the street where the ball would have to reach for the home run. So it was like there is a home run area, but it is sort of in name only. And so you really had to like develop your it was sort of a hard-nosed, old school gritty baseball that we want to see back.
Yeah, my greatest wiffle ball accomplishment, and again, I'm very happy we brought this segment back, reminiscing about my athletic past. We used to play like 2-on-2 with a couple of my middle school friends into high school. And they were both like, you know, the team that it was always the same teams. And so the kids that I pitched against were both lefties. So I once tried to pitch an inning left-handed. And I pitched a 1-2-3 inning left-handed on three pitches in which they took huge swings and grounded the ball right into the pool, which was, you know, located
for that pool.
I know. Yeah. It took a lot of base hits away. It was great. Great glove, the pool. And so that was, you know, just like three old school Pedro Feliciano curveballs, that kind of looping slider from the left side.
Yeah, the wiffle ball, the big wiffle ball curveball. You know, you line up the seams that one. Yeah, I know how to throw it.
Yeah, so that was, I have not let them forget about that. And that was, you know, 20 something years ago.
Did you have stickball in New Jersey?
We did not play stickball. We were aware of the concept, but it was not something we played in the street or anything like that.
So stickball was big where I grew up on Long Island. We had like, but it wasn't the stickball you see like in the old timey pictures. We played like throwing as hard as you could with a tennis ball against a chalked strike zone on the side of a school. Very fun game. We should talk more about the Mets. The offense seems to be coming around a little bit as well. Most of it is Brandon Nimmo, but Luis Guillorme getting on base a ton, making a little case for himself to keep playing time once J.D. Davis comes back. We could talk about the logic of that because to me, I don't know. And then James McCann chipping in with a home run. You start seeing... Okay, yeah, this is the offense I was psyched about a week ago.
Yeah, I think the verb that I used yesterday or Wednesday was percolate. Like you can see the offense percolating and starting to build towards something. It has been Nimmo basically by himself until, you know, Tuesday's eighth inning essentially. And then you've seen Alonso got the big hit in Tuesday's first game. Nimmo had a few big hits on Tuesday's nightcap. Jonathan Villar chipped in. But then on Wednesday, you had a three-hit game for Dom Smith. And he had also homered earlier in the week. Francisco Lindor is starting to hit the ball harder. So you're starting to see the depth of that lineup come to play where, you know, McCann hit that home run out of the seven spot. Jeff McNeil is still hitting the ball hard, even if he's not getting quite the results that he would like. So you're starting to see like what this offense can be. I think they've still only scored more than five runs once in the 1-8-run game they had against Philly when it was basically Vince Velasquez walking everyone. You're getting a sense for when the offense is clicking that, man, it's going to be really tough because you're going to have someone of Michael Conforto's ilk or Jeff McNeil's ilk hitting sixth and seventh on a daily basis.
And, you know, for all that they've struggled now after those games, You don't want a team OPS of 726. At least we don't think so. We don't really know what the ball's going to do this year. But a team OPS of 726 right now is good for fourth in the National League. So after all of that concern or whatever about their early offensive funk, I think it's pretty clear they're coming out of it. And they are going to cruise. They're going to cruise now.
Yeah, it's been weird looking around at how different National League teams are performing.
No optimistic prediction I've made about the Mets has ever not come true.
I mean, Dom Smith is how many? He's within 73.
He's not quite on the 75 pace at this point, but he's got two.
So he's closing in on it. Yeah. I think we can officially put the countdown on the Pepsi. I'm sorry, the Coca-Cola corner. We could have the countdown working soon. But yeah, like looking around the National League, and like since I wrote our power rankings, I was looking at all the teams and just the overall offensive numbers that you see. There's so many guys hitting below 200. Like the Braves, you know, it's like Ronald Acuna has a 4,000 OPS. And no one else on the team has reached base all season. It's a remarkable achievement that they've got going there. There's just a lot of teams that haven't put it together. The Cubs, I think, have been worse with runners in scoring position than the Mets had been earlier in the year. So there's just a lot of offensive volatility going on. There's really no one outside of Cincinnati has been hitting the ball consistently well, and even the Reds have tailed off a bit.
It's a bit of a small sample size, you might say. Right now, the Padres have a 2.48 team ERA, and the Cardinals have a 5.09 team ERA. You get broad ranges at this part of the season because it's all so few games. We have an interesting question from a reader that I'd like to pass along. It's from Aaron. And Aaron wants to know, he said, I thought the conversation you and Tim had about the Conforto hit by pitch was really interesting. I agree with your views on the importance of integrity and that leaning into a pitch is wrong. I don't know if I said anything about the importance of integrity, because that's not something, I don't know, that's not something I normally put a ton of importance on. I just want to be clear, it's lousy. It's not the aesthetically that's the sport I want to watch guys leaning into pitches. But he says, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on why pitch framing is treated so differently. Framing is essentially tricking an umpire into making the wrong call. Despite that, framing is seen as a valuable skill, and catchers are evaluated based on how well they frame pitches. Why is this accepted, but leaning into pitches is reviled? They both seem to be improper advantage seeking. Would love to hear what you guys think. Do you have an answer for this? Because this is something I have previously thought about quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, you suggested you were passionate about it. I am not passionate about it. I would say it's basically because pitch framing is subtle and because it, you know, like we yeah. don't, we can put a number on it now, but we didn't for the longest time. It's not like, you know, Reggie Miller, when he was playing for the Pacers, you would see always like trying to draw fouls by flailing his arms everywhere. And that just bothered Knicks fans everywhere and basketball purists.
No one likes a flopper.
Pitch framing doesn't come across that way, right? It doesn't come across like you're trying to sell it to an ump that much. And when you see a guy who like tries to do it a bit more egregiously, like, you know, take a pitch that's 3 inches outside and like swing your arm right back into the zone, I think a fan would roll his eyes at that. It's really because it's just such a subtle movement that you almost don't pick up on it as a fan unless you're really looking for it.
Yeah, you don't get that call because the umpire resents it if you do that, and then you don't get the call. Like, in fact, like within 30 seconds of my reading Aaron's email the first time, it was with Ty Walker on the mound, and he threw a pitch like right. It was a borderline pitch right at the bottom of the strike zone, and McCann, I think it was McCann, pulled it up like so quickly into the zone that I almost felt like it cost Walker the call because it felt like he moved a little too much. I think my answer is that flopping in another sport or the hit by pitch is a little bit different, but there's no good comp for balls and strikes in other sports because balls and strikes are a judgment call that is going to be made. Like it has to be made. If a pitch is not swung at, then the umpire has to determine whether that is a ball or a strike. And so by framing the pitch, the catcher is trying to take best advantage of the, you know, his positioning in the strike zone to get that call, to get that borderline call. I don't think it's reasonable to ask a catcher to say, oh, like that looks like it's out of the strike zone to me, so I'm not going to do a good frame job on this, because the catcher's job, you know, what they're trying to do, if you talk to the catchers about framing, is move as little as possible and just, you know, and you know, sort of keep the pitch where it is. And if there are different ways you can emphasize with body language where it is, it might help a little bit. But I think that, you know, like you said, it's a very subtle thing, and it is attempting to influence this call that has to be made one way or the other. Whereas if you were sticking your arm into the pitch, or if you are flopping, you are like trying to affect a call that otherwise would not exist. And so I think that's the difference, that I think it's almost unreasonable to expect guys not to try to frame pitches. Like I think that because it's going to happen, like it's only natural for catchers to do everything they can to get that call. Just like a base runner who on a close play at first base, you know, throwing his arms out in the safe motion to try to like as if it's going to subtly indicate the umpire's call. I think it's an instinct thing. I don't know. It's just, to me, it feels like a distinctly different act than breaking the rule. Like, I mean, what Conforto did broke the rule, and so he shouldn't have gotten first base for it, but even before flopping was against the rules in or, you know, some of the rules in college basketball and in soccer, you're trying to create a penalty where none should exist, whereas there's no penalty to a ball or strike. It's just, this is a call that's going to be made one way or the other.
I think the thing that probably sticks in people's craw about the Conforto thing, and like the uncharitable reading of that, is that he did not feel confident enough in getting the hit himself that he decided to stick his elbow out there. Mm-hmm. Like we talked about last time, there's not enough time between the pitch being thrown and Conforto's elbow getting there for him to like consciously make that decision and go through that thought process. But I think that's how, you know, I don't listen to talk radio too much these days, but I think that's how talk radio would read something like that. Was like, it's a clear sign of a lack of confidence that he just wants to get on base that way. So that's the uncharitable reading of it. That's the reason it feels worse. You know, like how different would we be talking about Michael Conforto's start to the season if that's a clean base hit to right field?
Or even it's a walk-off hit.
Or even if he gets walked in that spot, if he lays off some good pitches, it's a different feel to it. So I think that's why that instance, you know, in particular sticks out to people as being just like not a fun way to win, as we talked about.
Well, and Conforto is so very much in the spotlight right now because he, you know, his contract is sort of, I think, on a lot of people's minds. I had suggested, you know, the game log thing for the nervous, you know, just going through Baseball Reference game logs and trying to find, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 game stretches where he's been that bad. I have since done that. It is extremely easy to find 5 or 6 or 7. So like, I think the last 5 or 6 games of last season, he had a rough 5 games. No one was like, oh, we need to wait out to see if Conforto's right before they sign him to an extension, because he had those 5 bad games at the end of last season. Just as no one said that even as early as April 24th to May 2nd of 2019, when in an 8-game stretch, he went 3-for-24 with 11 strikeouts, a 489 OPS. Like, I still think, and I understand the case, oh, he's pressing, he's got the contract talk in the airwaves or whatever, like, it's on his mind, he's trying to, I get it, like, I think it's natural to read things that way. I can't believe that that's what's happening, because it's too few games for to say that it's real, and because Conforto has just been too good against across his career to say there's no chance. If he could press over this, there's no chance and that's really the issue, then there's no chance he hasn't pressed before. And if there's no chance he hasn't pressed before, then there's no way he hasn't overcome that in the past. And so I'm just naturally moved to think he will overcome it, and soon, because that's what good baseball players do.
Yeah, I mean, he's always been a streaky hitter, right? Like, he's always gone through stretches like this, and then he bounces back with a stretch where it doesn't seem like he can make an out. The difference last year, which was only in 60 games, was like he didn't really have that two-week stretch where he looked a little bit lost. You know, you mentioned right at the end of the season, then he got hurt and missed the last like four or five games or whatever it was. But other than that, didn't have like that fortnight where you weren't sure what he was going to do at the plate. It was more of the hot stretch for most of the season that he carried through. And so that's the question about him is, you know, was 2020 just a prolonged period where he was hot more or less for 2 months? Or was that a, you know, kind of what you can expect from him moving forward? And that's the distance between like the team asking the question and Conforto and his representatives probably saying, well, of course you can. This is the guy you can see going forward. Like he did it for the full season, regardless of how many games that full season was. And he's been good enough in the past for you to believe that at this age he has just hit his prime. So that's why I think 2021 is so interesting for him, is it kind of hammers down like who he is as a player, whether it is, you know, the full breakthrough Michael Conforto of 2020, or just the really nice player that he's been before that.
Well, I have a feeling we will talk about Michael Conforto again in the future.
Okay, I you know, I wasn't sure if we needed to get it all out now between, you know, before.
Because I feel like this will be a topic we discuss again.
Yeah, that's probably true. There's only so many guys on the team, I guess, and we do this twice a week. And they only play twice a week, so.
Yeah. So next show, if there's a game, we'll say Michael Conforto hit three home runs in this game. I think we're past it. Or we'll say Michael Conforto struck out twice in this game. He is even mired more deeply into this horrible funk. But again, it will still be only 9 games into the season because they're not going to play 3 games in Colorado because they don't play games anymore.
I'm trying to decide how, like, the extreme cold that not extreme cold, I guess. The weather on Saturday is supposed to be like 20 and maybe even lower than that by the end of the game in Denver. Like, whether that helps out pitchers or hitters more. Because I'm trying to remember, like, the early, you know, the late March Little League games in the cold weather. I feel like it just led to a lot of walks. So I think you can extrapolate like from my Little League experience.
Yeah, a lot of stinging. If you hit the ball poorly, it hurts a lot.
Yeah, like I think everyone will be wearing batting gloves all around the park on Saturday.
Even Luis Guillorme?
I think we might even see Luis Guillorme in batting gloves. That'll be interesting to watch. I'll have to watch the game specifically for that on Saturday.
And this is something else I'm sure we'll talk about more, but before we go that real quick, because I teased it earlier, when is J.D. Davis coming back, and will Luis Guillorme continue starting at third base?
So Davis is eligible to come off the injured list on Saturday, and Luis Rojas said on Wednesday, on Thursday, so many days in the week, that Davis could be back as soon as Saturday. Like, they could be activating him that first day that he's ready, even though he hasn't seen live pitching since he's been on the IL. You know, his last live pitching was when he was last in a major league game. Ideally, you would like a guy to see live pitching before he comes back, but they don't really have that possibility.
At the alternate site?
Well, I think it's because he wasn't ready for it before they were flying to Denver. And so it was kind of, if he did it at the alternate site, then he has to fly on his own. And if he flies commercial, then you're not allowed to be like right in with the team right away. So that's the issue there.
Oh, man. What a world we live in. I mean, good. That's good. That's a good thing that they would have that protocol, right? But I forgot all about it. I didn't, you know, you don't think about these things when you just want to see the baseball players come back.
So, and with Guillorme and VR, I mean, both of them have played reasonably well while Davis has been out. VR had the couple big hits on Tuesday. Guillorme's on base percentage, I think, plummeted down to like 500 because he took an offer on Wednesday night. Otherwise,
he's up to like 530, I think.
Okay. Is it? Okay. I knew it was like 727 at one point. And he's played a really, you know, a fine third base since the early couple of errors that he made that didn't seem characteristic. He made a great play. I think it was on Rhys Hoskins on Wednesday night, throwing across. Mm-hmm. So I think Davis is still the guy there, but I don't think he's going to be a 7 out of 7 starter there on the, you know, every week. I think it's probably going to be like he starts 5 times and you give Guillorme or VR some starts in there as well. And, you know, mm-hmm. also eventually when you get to the point in the season where the Mets will be playing more than a handful of games a week and they start playing every day for extended periods of time, you'll see other guys who are normally starters get days off. And that will help, you know, like we haven't seen Albert Almora Jr. start a game yet. Tomas Nito has only started the one game that actually happened.
Right.
So it's been tough. You know, it's been tough for Rojas to get some of those backups in action and some of the back end guys in the bullpen. Like Robert Gazelman has not thrown a competitive pitch since the end of spring training, which was like 2.5 weeks ago. So it's been tough for those guys to stay sharp. And I think we'll see more of a rotation, especially at a position like third, as we start to get them playing a bit more consistently.
Well, and it's going to be a good thing to have when they have to play like 90 games in 30 days to end the season or whatever it is.
Yeah, like the Cardinals last year. You know, you need that positional position player depth and pitching depth when you get into those stretches. I think they've got a stretch already where it's like 31 games in 30 days or something around June. So that will test them out. But, you know, they pursued a lot of depth in the offseason, and this is why you do that. So you're ready for those spots.
And this is why you have a guy like Guillorme and a guy, right, like why it's useful to have both a guy like Guillorme who can play everywhere and be a convincing defender everywhere and fill in wherever you need him, and a guy like Davis who, you know, I mean, I think you'd rather have him be an elite defender and be able to play everywhere, but I think, you know, you can sort of take on a guy like that when you have the defensive options in your pocket to replace him late in the game, or if you have a heavy ground ball pitcher, or for whatever other reason, and still keep JD Davis's bat on the team and in the lineup as a net positive.
Yeah, and I think what they decide to do at third base long term, or even on a daily basis, doesn't always hinge on how those guys specifically or individually are doing. It depends on like the lineup as a whole. If you've got 7 other guys in the lineup who are just mashing, then, you know, it's a little easier to start Luis Guillorme and give away a little bit of the offensive potential that Davis has and the power and the slug and play Guillorme instead for the defensive value he brings. If your team is in more of an offensive slump, like the Mets had been earlier in the season, then you probably want to get Davis's bat in there to potentially spark them. You know, that's kind of, it's not just a who's better at baseball, JD Davis or Luis Guillorme. It's who's the better fit for today's lineup and the lineup going forward, and that brings some other factors into it.
Well, I look forward to seeing how it plays out, and Tim, I look forward to talking about all of this more next week.
Yeah, let's talk about multiple baseball games next week.
Let's hope so. You can ask us questions. Thanks again to Aaron for his question. If you email me at asktedberg@gmail.com, we will probably answer it. You can get at Tim on Twitter at Tim Britton. I am at OG Ted Berg. Tim, as always, thank you and peace out.
Adios.